Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the mainstream media has been mainly preoccupied with Hurricane Irma's impact on Florida. It has made it difficult to get information on the major 8.1 earthquake that struck Mexico on Thursday, September 7th. Over 95 people have been killed, and that number may rise. 2.5 million people are in need of assistance. Our guest is Mexico City-based Laura Carlson. And we continue our new series, Campaigners for Black Lives. We speak with Eddie Anderson, a supporter of the New Poor People's Campaign. It is the revitalization of a campaign begun by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, but he was assassinated before he was able to fully implement the campaign. And we return to our occasional series, Cosmology on Sojourner Truth. We discuss the elusive neutrino particles with MIT professor and physicist David Kaiser. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Part of Florida inched back toward normal, with workers restoring power, clearing roads, and replenishing gas supplies, even as teams scoured the state's southernmost islands and authorities warned of mass devastation. Florida Governor Rick Scott briefed reporters after surveying the damage in the Florida Keys.
The trailer parks, I mean, it's like everybody just tipped everything over. You're just praying that everybody's alive. I've been talking to the people down there. We're still having in the Keys issues with getting the water started back up, sewage, and their power back up.
Residents drifted back from shelters and faraway havens this week to see Hurricane Irma's scattershot destruction. Many streets remained flooded, and the count of damaged and totaled homes ticked upwards even as some curfews were lifted, flights resumed, and amusement park rides opened. As crews labored to repair the lone highway connecting the Keys, residents of some of the islands closest to Florida's mainland were allowed to return and get their first look at the devastation 2 days after Irma roared in with 130-mile-per-hour winds. FEMA said preliminary estimates suggested that 25% of the homes in the Keys were destroyed and 65% sustained major damage. Facebook said Tuesday that some of the ads bought by Russians on the platform last year promoted events during the U.S. presidential campaign. It's an indication that alleged meddling ahead of the 2016 election went beyond social media. The social media giant said in a statement that its takedown of what the company last week called Russian-affiliated pages included shutting down several promoted events. Facebook declined to provide details of the promoted events. Facebook said last week that an operation likely based in Russia had placed thousands of U.S. ads with polarizing views on topics such as immigration, race, and gay rights on the site during a 2-year period through May 2017. U.S. Senator Mark Warner on Tuesday said he was disappointed in Facebook for failing to present the latest information during a briefing last week with staff of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is investigating allegations of Russian election interference. Facebook said it will continue working with U.S. authorities as necessary. Russian President Vladimir Putin has denied that his government intervened in the election to help Donald Trump win. The Daily Beast reported that one Russia-funded advertisement promoted an anti-immigrant rally in Idaho in August of last year. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders introduced his single-payer Medicare for All bill today. Sanders was unveiling his bill the same day Republican senators were rolling out details of a last-ditch effort to repeal and replace President Obama's health care law. Sanders said Tuesday on a social media statement that his measure has picked up support from many Democrats, including Senators Kamala Harris of California, Cory Booker of New Jersey, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts.
And I'm very proud to be introducing a Medicare for All legislation, which now has 15 co-sponsors here in the U.S. Senate and dozens of grassroots organizations behind us.
Sanders' aides said the measure would likely be financed by income-adjusted premiums people would pay the government, ranging from no premiums for the poorest Americans to high levies on the rich and corporations. The measure has no chance of becoming law with Republicans controlling the White House and Congress. California Governor Jerry Brown and State Senate Leader Kevin De Leon have reached an agreement on a bill that would prohibit state law enforcement from collaborating with federal immigration authorities on immigration enforcement. And as Christopher Martinez reports, the so-called state sanctuary bill still faces some opposition.
Immigrant rights activists are calling the deal a victory. Angela Chan is with Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus.
It does increase protections in the vast majority of counties in California. Currently, for example, counties in counties such as Fresno, Contra Costa, San Mateo, San Bernardino, and the counties throughout California have very little protections in terms of limiting local law enforcement collaboration with ICE.
The goal of the measure is to limit local police cooperation with federal immigration officials. It would bar police and sheriffs from asking people about their immigration status, arresting people on immigration warrants, or acting as deputized immigration agents. But the California Sheriffs Association is still opposed.
In the end, we can't support legislation that limits our ability to protect our communities, to support a symbolic attempt to impact federal law and policy.
Santa Barbara Sheriff Bill Brown is president of the California State Sheriffs Association. He says sheriffs appreciate the amendments, but he says the bill still protects serious criminals.
We would still not be permitted to notify federal authorities if we were releasing those people from our custody. We feel that that's not appropriate.
SB 54 has already passed out of the Senate. A vote in the full assembly could come Thursday or Friday. On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. On Thursday, September 7th, around 11:50 p.m., an 8.1 magnitude earthquake off the southern coast of Mexico hit off Chiapas State, the city of San Cristobal de las Casas, near the Guatemalan border. The quake was felt throughout the region. The quake occurred in a seismically active region, and this region has seen at least six other quakes of magnitude 7.0 or greater since 1900. What I'd like to do now is to start off with two short clips, one from United News International, the other from Euronews.
The death toll rises in the wake of one of the strongest earthquakes to ever hit Mexico. On Monday, September 11th, Mexico's Foreign Relations Department said at least 95 people were killed by the 8.1 magnitude quake that struck off Mexico's southern coast on Thursday. Most of the deaths occurred in Oaxaca State, while others were reported in Chiapas and Tabasco. The tremor is the most powerful to hit the country in a century. Thousands of homes were damaged or destroyed across the three states, and a third of homes in the city of Juchitán are now said to be uninhabitable. Many residents are sleeping outside in fear of more collapses as scores of aftershocks shook the region. The U.S. Geological Survey said at least six measured above 5.0 magnitude. Mexico's Foreign Relations Department said it had to withdraw an aid package intended for Houston, Texas, as the city recovers from last month's hurricane.
Soldiers hand out food and water to people who have potentially lost everything. Hundreds of thousands of Mexicans have been left without electricity and water. As details of the disaster emerged, officials say up to 2 million people in Mexico's poorer south have been affected by the quake. Thousands of homes have been destroyed. Some people say they're frustrated that the southern regions were still not getting the help they needed from the richer areas of the north and center of the country. Mexico's president has declared 3 days of national mourning and pledged to rebuild shattered towns and villages.
Now here to discuss all of this with us, one of our regulars. I'd like to welcome back Laura Carlson, political analyst and writer based in Mexico. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration and gender issues in a number of outlets. She's also columnist for the Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, a commentator on various radio and television stations, and she herself is the host of a Mexican television program. Laura, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, so Laura, with all of the wall-to-wall, back-to-back coverage of, in particular, Florida and along the U.S. coast, some coverage given in particular to the U.S. territories in the Caribbean, but there's been complaints also about the lack of coverage on what has happened in the Caribbean, also Cuba, that was devastated by Hurricane Irma. But you hardly see anything at all about this devastating earthquake in Mexico, 2.5 million people in need of assistance. And, you know, the number of dead may very well go up. And then you just heard in that clip that some people in the southern regions, very hard hit, are complaining about the lack of support that they're getting more from the north or basically from the central government. Laura Carlson, we know that when an act of nature happens, that that is often made worse, exacerbated by man-made problems. What your analysis of what is happening?
Well, it certainly was a very strong earthquake, and the damage in this area is extensive, although you won't see figures, dollar figures, for very high damages, because we're talking about an area that's populated by mostly smaller indigenous communities, and there are small houses that represented for these families everything they owned, everything they had built up over a lifetime that were ruined in the area. The problem that is typical in Mexico and other places as well, but Mexico is unfortunately notorious for this, is that once the natural disaster strikes and it's in the news for a few days and the politicians go down and give their speeches and show the photo ops against the rubble that remains after the disaster, the aid is slow in coming and much of it ends up being pocketed by the politicians themselves. So this is the fear of the people. They are complaining that it hasn't been fast enough, that they are completely without any options. On the other hand, what we see is that the society itself has come together and continues to come together to try to help these people. There are all kinds of collections being taken up in Mexico City and in other places throughout the country to send down to this area that's known as the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, and this skinny strip of land that is between the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific Ocean where the epicenter of the earthquake was and that was the hardest hit.
Right. And, you know, often there is a kind of a politicization of relief or politicization of aid. We certainly saw this when the terrible earthquake hit in Haiti. And a lot of that certainly was going on then, and also a lot of money collected by the Red Cross that never then made it to the people who were most impacted. Indeed, the Red Cross turned out to have built like 6 or 8 homes, you know, following that earthquake. But just in terms of the division of wealth, we certainly know that there's a lot of impoverishment in Mexico. But that area I mentioned earlier, San Cristobal de las Casas, is that near in Chiapas State? Isn't that where a kind of a stronghold of the Zapatistas and the movement, supporting the Zapatistas? Laura.
Yes, that's right. And again, that's an area where there are a lot of indigenous communities. The state of Chiapas was hard hit near San Cristobal, near the southern border there. They're talking about 41,000 homes that have been affected and people that are virtually homeless They're the state of Oaxaca next door. These are the two poorest states, basically, in Mexico. So you're again in this situation where natural disasters tend to affect the most vulnerable people. There can be exceptions depending on where they strike, but it means that it's hardest for them to recover, because even though they lost less in monetary terms, it was all that they had, and the government typically gives one less attention to these populations that don't have political power or economic power. And so once the spotlights are off from the media, the national and the international media, oftentimes they're left without anything to rebuild with. In the state of Oaxaca, it's also true that they were indigenous communities, and it's also true that there are communities in resistance in the Huave region near Juchitán, which was the city that was most hardest hit by the earthquake. In fact, they estimate that in that township, more than half of the deaths that are now approaching 100 and will probably soon surpass 100 once they've been able to take the census, happened in the municipality of Juchitán. And there are indigenous communities that have been protesting a mega project of wind power that was taking over their lands and their natural resources in the area. So again, you have people that are hardest hit, that are least able to confront this, and that have been defending their lands and now have to deal with this.
Yeah, and, you know, one really has to, you know, we have to keep our eye on this, because, as you say, that is an area where there are strongholds of resistance, as you said earlier. And there's so much buying and selling of people, especially when people are desperate. And, you know, the government comes in with resources as well. They should. But then who gets access to those resources, and how are those resources kind of dished out? You know what I mean? Who gets it and who doesn't get it? So one of the things that we talked a little bit about yesterday when we covered on the show, our main focus was the Caribbean region and Irma and the Caribbean region, was a kind of a double standard. And, you know, sometimes these things are really subtle, watching them play out. I remember years ago when I was working in the UN for, you know, doing movement work, but at the UN level, a document was discovered that a price is actually put on individual lives, that when a disaster hits and people are trying to figure out, you know, international aid, right? And that paper that was leaked, I think, by a British newspaper, I can't remember which one it was, basically said that the life of someone in the global south was worth 14 times less than the life of people living in the global north. And I think we have to keep that in mind when we're looking at the response from former colonial powers in the United States to the tragedy going on now, the catastrophe in the Caribbean region, the islands that were hit during the hurricane, but also to take a look at this kind of north-south divide in Mexico, and also indigenous populations, because we know that everywhere in Central America, that there's a lot of discrimination against indigenous populations. Just some final thoughts on that, Laura.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't surprise me, the report you mentioned, but it certainly jives with what we see here. There's a cynical reaction typically on the part of politicians to first take advantage of the natural disaster to portray themselves as the white knights that come riding in and promise all sorts of aid, and then later take political advantage of the situation. We've already had reports here, and this is, again, unfortunately typical of Mexico, of aid going out literally with the name of the governor, as if this were a measure of largesse on almost a personal basis. And then the forms of distribution, we still don't have the information about that, but they're typically clientele kind of systems in which supporters are rewarded, opposition is punished, and people are bought off for the future. So there's a real lookout for that. And I do want to emphasize, though, that these kinds of forms of discrimination that happen in moments of extreme tragedy and that happen from above among the politicians are really contrasted to what happens at the grassroots level. Again, the collections that are being taken up in Mexico City, and this happened in 1985 with the huge earthquake that struck there, the government was really almost useless in terms of both immediate rescue measures and then subsequent delivery of aid, which they largely pocketed. And it was the people who came to the rescue, and that's happening again. And it's also happening on a binational level. We have organizations like the Indigenous Binational Front, FIAB there in Los Angeles, taking up collections. They've had more than $5,000 to buy needed items for the Isthmus of Tehuantepec already, and are opening, they have opened a GoFundMe site for people to give there. So you see both the people themselves within Mexico and the diaspora taking action, oftentimes in a situation where there's a conviction that the government will not respond adequately to the situation.
Yeah, Laura, could you give the name again of the Indigenous network that's collecting money and resources to help those in need in Mexico?
Yes, the initials are FIOB, FIOB. And their GoFundMe page, I believe, is called Solidarity with Oaxaca or United for Oaxaca. And you can find it there to just press a button to contribute to that effort, which will be delivering the needed goods. These are people who are from Oaxaca. They're migrants from Oaxaca. And many of them are from the Zapotec, Huave ethnic groups that are represented or that are present on the most affected lands within Oaxaca. So, again, they're probably individuals that have family and close ties to this region, and they're responding with their solidarity and asking others to support them in that.
Right. Well, we will post that information on our social media and our website, Facebook, etc., so our listeners could go there to find out how you could support grassroots efforts, ensuring really that the funding and money gets directly to those who are impacted. Laura Carlson, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to having a discussion with you on our show tomorrow on the NAFTA and the NAFTA negotiations. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And again, go to www.sotrueradio.org or go to the Sojourner Truth Facebook page. As soon as we're done with this show, we're going to make sure to get that information up so that you can help to support those who are suffering now in Mexico as a result of the earthquake. Now, in May, the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II proposed a new Poor People's Campaign, continuing the work of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King started this Poor People's Campaign, and he was assassinated shortly thereafter. Some key parts of this new Poor People's Campaign. I can't tell you how excited I was to hear about this campaign. I really want to be part of it as much as I could. The campaign is fighting to end systemic racism, poverty, militarism, environmental destruction, and related injustices, and to build a just, sustainable, and participatory society. They're aiming to build a broad and deep national moral movement rooted in the leadership of poor people and reflecting great moral teachings. And we're going to be discussing more of that. But first, just to give the early history of this campaign, I'd like to play two short clips, one of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. The source is from the film King, A Filmed Record, and then a clip from his wife, Coretta Scott King. now also the late Coretta Scott King, and the source for that is from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Power for poor people will really mean having the ability, the togetherness, the assertiveness, and the aggressiveness to make the power structure of this nation say yes when they may be desirous of saying no. And it is my hope that we will get together and be together and really stand up to gain power for poor people, black people, Mexican Americans, American Indians, Puerto Ricans, Appalachian whites, all working together to solve the problem of poverty. We're getting ready to deal with the economic issue. We're getting ready to demand jobs and income. We're tired of working full-time jobs for part-time income.
All right.
We're tired of living in run-down, dilapidated, rat-infested shacks and slums. We are tired of our children having to attend overcrowded, inferior schools.
Make it plain.
And we are tired of our men not being able to be men because they can't find work.
There is no reason why a nation as rich as ours should be blighted by poverty, disease, and illiteracy. It is plain that we don't care about our poor people except to exploit them as cheap labor and victimize them through excessive rents and consumer prices. Our Congress passes laws which subsidize corporation farms, oil companies, airlines, and houses for suburbia. But when they turn their attention to the poor, they suddenly become concerned about balancing the budget and cut back on funds for Head Start, Medicare, and mental health appropriations. The most tragic of these cuts is the welfare section to the Social Security Amendment, which freezes federal funds for millions of needy children who are desperately poor but who do not receive public assistance. It forces mothers to leave their children and accept work or training, leaving their children to grow up in the streets as tomorrow's social problems. This law must be repealed.
All righty. And part of the clip from Coretta Scott King. I would now like to welcome Pastor Eddie Anderson. He's a friend of Black Lives Matter and a partner with Black Lives Matter National's Sacred Resistance effort. And of course, we partner with Black Lives Matter with our weekly series on campaigners for Black Lives. Pastor Eddie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Margaret.
Okay. So as I said earlier, Pastor Eddie Anderson, I'm really excited about this and I want about this campaign. And I want you to know I'll be back in touch with you because I definitely want to be part of that campaign. And I know a number of the community-based organizations I'm part of want to endorse this campaign and want to be part of it. It is really so important. Tell us why and how you got involved in it.
Why I got involved in it is because my faith moved me to get involved. I'm an African-American man. I'm originally raised in Atlanta from the South, went to Morehouse College. And my faith tells me that the way you treat the least of these is the way that you treat God, right? The way that we treat Jesus. Jesus says, if you're doing the least of these, you do also unto me. And so when I came to L.A. and I saw Skid Row and I saw how they were criminalizing the poor, criminalizing poverty, criminalizing black men, I felt something needed to be done. And I've heard of a Parkinson's campaign, and then Dr. Barber mentioned it in May. And I'm also a Disciples of Christ, which is a denomination Dr. Barber is a part of. And I met Dr. Barber this summer at our General Assembly, and I was very moved to get involved and to make sure that in L.A., we are raising our voices and magnifying the voices of those who are muffled, and join those voices across the country would say that we are fighting for the morality and the soul of our nation, that we need to take care of all of these, of all people, and all humanity is sacred because we are all created in the image of God.
Yeah, and Pastor Eddie Anderson, you were one of dozens of pastors nationwide that signed a resolution supporting the new Poor People's Campaign. One of the things the resolution says is, quote, while we as disciples open our hands to the poor and engage in direct service, we need to question the policies and practices that keep the poor in poverty. And one of the things, certainly in terms of the community work that I do, but also on this show, I've been really very, very concerned about how impoverished people, or the word poor half the time, is not coming out of the mouths of of elected officials. There is a lot of talk about the middle class, and when one talks about the poor, they talk about the working poor. But there are millions of people. First of all, who isn't working? It's a lot of work to be homeless, right? It's a lot of work to be a mom on welfare, trying to raise your kids, as Tupac says, trying to make a dollar out of 99 cents. Those are some of the hardest working folks. So I don't know anybody who isn't working. So, you know, I think really it's a false division. And you heard Coretta Scott King talk about welfare there. And we know the devastating impact that President Clinton's welfare reform has had on this country, devastating so many communities. And they are millions of people in this country without any kind of income whatsoever. So, Pastor Eddie Anderson, are you hoping that this campaign would really help to raise up some of those issues, but also to look in the policy area to see what can be done about all this?
Absolutely. I'm hoping that this campaign will not only build a fusion coalition of grassroots people who can lift up not only the issue, but stories, like stories of people that we know every single day, some of our own stories, and talk about how poverty is devastating not only our lives, but our humanity, our community, our families. And I'm glad that one part of Dr. Barber's campaign is that they're going to do an audit and show the, some of the systematic injustices and systems which basically help poverty to continue in our country, that poverty has become an economy for some people in our country, and that that is just morally unjust, and that we have to say that that's not okay, not in our country, not in our name, that we will not stand for that any longer.
Right, and certainly, you know, I know that the aim of the campaign is to be broad and deep, and it says the leadership rooted in the leadership of poor people. I was really glad to see that, because for so long we have had a lot of large funded non-governmental organizations, some of whom may be well-meaning, but, you know, who put themselves of, in a position of speaking for people who are impoverished, and people who are indeed impoverished then don't get the platform. Or don't get to say what their needs and demands are. And a lot of times people then start focusing on what will bring in their next grant as opposed to what really will undermine and help to end poverty. So, Pastor Eddie Anderson, we're going to please keep us informed, because we're really here on Sojourner Truth. We're going to do what we can to support this effort. And in fact, I see WRFG Community Radio in Atlanta. They also air Sojourner Truth. They're one of the endorsers. And I'm going to be asking, why isn't Pacifica Radio as a whole an endorser? Okay.
That's a good question. make that happen.
Absolutely. So, Pastor Eddie Anderson, thank you so very much for joining us. And we want to thank Dr. Malina Abdullah of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. We are partnering with Black Lives Matter on this series of campaigners for Black Lives. Pastor Eddie Anderson, thank you. And I hope to be able to meet you very soon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Likewise.
All righty. We are going to take a station break. And coming up, you know, with all of the trouble and everything else we're facing in the world, hurricanes, earthquakes, racists in the White House, you know, we forget our connection with all there is. And coming up, we're going to return to our occasional series on Cosmology on Sojourner Truth with MIT professor and physicist Dr. David Kaiser. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
All from the Indians, welcome to pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled a plain, like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain, looking for the rain. Just like the city that stagger on the coast.
The late great genius of Gil Scott-Heron, the song Winter in America. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, you can subscribe for a free podcast where you could hear the show anywhere in the nation or indeed the world. Also, we are on SoundCloud, so you can just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we're also on Facebook. You can like and friend us on Facebook if you're a member, and you can also check out our show and all of our back shows. They're all archived on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Mexico. Now, long time ago, I read a short newspaper article, a little clipping, that said there's a particle that came from the sun, but was found inside huge rocks. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I was hooked. That particle turned out to be called neutrinos, a particle that my daughter, herself a particle physicist, dubs as her mom's favorite particle. Then I found out that each and every one of us, and I'll have to add that my guess is all living things, that's just me saying, but at least each and every one of us is human beings, that we have billions of neutrinos inside us. So even as you're drinking your tea or your coffee, you're listening to this show right now, they're neutrinos. You got them, okay? Does that mean that we're made in part of stardust? The neutrino was first theorized in 1930 by the team of Italian physicist Enrico Fermi. It was then said to have no mass whatsoever, but does it? What do we know about neutrinos and mass? Also, have any neutrinos ever been seen or caught interacting with each other or anything? They are complex, and they are from what is now known three different types of neutrinos. And wait, there's more. They oscillate. But what does that mean? Are they changing form? And what is superposition? And what does that have to do with neutrinos? Furthermore, at one time, neutrinos were thought to be faster than the speed of light. But has that theory been debunked? Was Einstein right or wrong? How much of the universe is likely made up of neutrinos? And what is the relevance to dark matter and dark energy of neutrinos? Now, to kick us off there, because clearly I'm not the only one fascinated by neutrinos. There are millions of people who are. And indeed, the Corrigan brothers and Pete Creighton actually did the neutrino song. Let's hear a little of that song right now.
We'll be right back. Toodaloo, 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 toodaloo. He's light now slower than a neutrino. We can't believe it, we weren't prepared. Does E still equal MC squared? Now that the neutrino has taken flight and is seemingly faster than the speed of light. Toodaloo, 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 toodaloo. Is light now slower than a neutrino? Was old Albert wrong? Oh, can it be that fabulous theory of relativity is being debunked for the first time? But he still might be right, old Albert Einstein. Toodaloo, 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 toodaloo. Is light now slower than a neutrino? Now physics forever may not be the same, and boffins are gonna be driven insane. If light's not the fastest, what can this mean? Oh, and is something faster than the neutrino? Turaloo, turaloo.
All right, that's the neutrino song. And on that note, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Professor David Kaiser, professor of the history of science at MIT's program in science, technology, and society, and also professor of physics in MIT's Department of Physics. He completed an AB in physics at Dartmouth College, a PhD in physics and the history of science at Harvard University. His physics research focuses on early universe cosmology, working at the interface of particle physics and gravitation. He has also helped to design novel experiments to test the foundations of quantum theory. He's the author of several books, including How Hippies Say Physics, Science, Counterculture, and Quantum Revival, and a new book, American Physics and the Cold War Bubble, is on its way. David Kaiser, it's been way too long. Welcome back.
Well, Margaret, thanks so much. It's a great pleasure to be back on the show.
Okay. What did you think of the neutrino song?
I loved it. I did not know that song. And, you know, we'll add it to the collection. You may know there's also, in the spirit of celebrating this noble particle in song and verse, there's a well-known lengthy poem by the great American poet John Updike, a kind of ode to the neutrino as well. So this particle has inspired you and your daughter, my friend and colleague, and many, many people. It's a marvelous topic, and I look forward to talking about it with you.
Just for the layperson, understanding what exactly is a neutrino, you know what I mean? Like, is it – can has anybody seen it? Has anybody seen it interacting? And where does it come from?
Sure. Those are great, great questions. And so people have seen them in the way that physicists try to see elementary particles. We can't quite see them with our eyes. But people have built really impressive, sometimes enormous machines to try to catch these little wispy, these shy little particles and catch them interacting with other more common forms of matter. So it was a quarter century, it took 25 years between the time when theoretical physicists dreamed up this possibility for this kind of particle in the early 1930s, as you mentioned. It took a quarter century until the first real experimental evidence that these things really exist. They're in our world and not just in our thoughts. And so they're really hard to pin down. Partly that's because, as their name suggests, they are electrically neutral. They have no electric charge. That's the neutral part of the name neutrino. And that means that they don't interact in the ways that most matter interacts with each other. So it's very hard for physicists to catch them in the act, to see them jostling or interacting with other forms of matter. And yet our theories tell us that there should be a billion neutrinos for every single atom in the entire universe. They're much more plentiful than the ordinary stuff that makes up you and me and the planet and everything else. We're awash in them, just as you said. Tens of billions of them pass through every square centimeter of our bodies every second. Just
wow.
Look at the size of your thumbnail. That's about the size. Every area that size, about the size of your thumbnail, tens of billions of these critters pass through, and we don't even notice every second. So they are very hard to detect, and yet teams of physicists have been able to measure them, to really catch them in the act, since the mid-1950s, and increasingly with increasing sophistication, especially in the last 20 years or so.
Wow, that is truly amazing. So you're saying that neutrinos, they are found inside us. What about other living things? I mean, are you going to dash my, you know, fantasy about them being found in dense rocks?
They're found everywhere. In fact, they're not just found in us. They pass through us as if we're not even there. We're like a little, a pane of glass to them. They pass right through. So they're in us for the briefest flash of a moment, and then more pile up and pass through us again. And they pass through the rocks and the whole planet. In fact, they pass through the entire Earth, and most of them won't even sort of pause. Even the Earth itself is practically invisible to these particles. That's how weakly they interact with ordinary matter. So they stream through practically everything. So in the experiment that I got to think about with some colleagues most recently, it's an experiment based at Fermilab, a huge national laboratory outside Chicago. To measure these things, they actually had to use 5-ton slabs of steel and hundreds of them, so an enormous detector buried in an old mine underground, just to try to reliably catch a handful of these things every so often, because most neutrinos will blow through those 5-ton slabs of steel as if they're not even there. That's how ubiquitous they are, but also how weakly they interact with ordinary matter.
Right. And that's amazing. And you have written that they are fundamental to the construction of the universe. Clearly, they're very abundant. They move very, very quickly, as you say. So now we're told that there are, at least from what's known, 3 different types of neutrinos and that they oscillate. What does this oscillation mean? Are they changing form? And can you explain a superposition? I mean, I know that's totally unfair, but just for the layperson, because there's a connection with this oscillation of these neutrinos, I think, and something called superposition.
There is. You're exactly right. So I assume we have 7 hours for this discussion. Is that right, Margaret?
Absolutely.
Good. Oh, that's
no,
great.
But we want to do a full 1 hour with you very soon. So I hope let's try and organize that.
That would be terrific. I would love it. That would be great.
Uh-huh.
But in the meantime, because we don't have a full hour right now, you're right. You're absolutely right. Neutrinos have been confirmed to exist in 3 different varieties. They're very similar, but not exactly the same as each other. And we know that because they interact slightly differently with different types of ordinary matter. So type 1 will scatter off one type of well-known particle, but not a different type. Type 2 will scatter off a distinct form of matter. So we really can characterize these 3 different types of neutrino and show they're really not the same as each other. They also have a very slight difference in mass between them. They weigh slightly different amounts, what type 1 versus type 2 versus type 3. So they're like closely related cousins, but they're not the same. And now the weird thing comes in, just as you say, that a neutrino that might start out as one type of neutrino, say type 1, can actually shift and be measured as type 2 somewhere down the line, or type 2 can become type 1 or type 3. They can oscillate. And that was predicted or hypothesized back in the 1950s, but it took a long, long time, again, many decades, to get really clear, compelling experimental evidence that that's what happens. In fact, almost 2 years ago, the leaders of some of those very big experimental teams won the Nobel Prize. It was a Nobel Prize-worthy achievement just to show that these hypothetical oscillations really do occur in nature. So it's a really fascinating effect. And as you say, it goes right to the heart of our understanding of quantum theory. It has to do with this term you've used called superposition. And that's something that's very hard to get our heads around. Many, many physicists try, not just physicists. It's tricky. But there's a central notion in quantum theory that suggests that a property of some object really only becomes manifest, only takes form when we measure it. And in between measurements, the object might not have a definite value for that property. Here's how I like to think about that. It's as if I didn't have a definite value of my weight until I stepped on a scale. Wouldn't that be nice? You could forget about your weight in between measurements. And so the idea is that these neutrinos don't really have to choose whether they're really going to be type 1 or really going to be type 2 or type 3 until there's a definite measurement performed. Then they always have to give a definite answer. Hey, buddy, I'm type 1, or you caught me, I'm type 3. Right now you caught me being type 3 neutrino. But in between those measurements, they could exist in this kind of quantum dance of uncertainty, and they can really oscillate between those options, so we can then calculate how likely should it be to find these neutrinos popping up as type 2 versus type 1 in various sorts of experiments.
Right. They may be the original shapeshifters, right?
They are absolutely shapeshifters. Exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, we are going to do a full in-depth thing with you, Professor Kaiser. But quickly, what about this thing? How fast are they? Are they faster than the speed of light? Or is that really not true?
It's really not true. It was almost exactly 6 years ago, there was this very surprising announcement from a group in Italy, and they thought they'd found evidence that the neutrinos traveled ever so slightly faster than light, and that would have thrown all our books out the window. I mean, just everything. We'd start from scratch. It turns out that was due to an experimental error, a totally understandable, you know, tricky measurement. And once they straightened that out, they said, oh, okay, hang on, keep your textbooks. The speed of light is our fastest speed limit. And neutrinos really do travel very close to, but ever so slightly slower than, the speed of light. They travel practically at the speed of light. They do not travel faster than it. That was a little bit of a hiccup about 6 years ago, but the group did find the cause of that error.
Well, that happens. For people who want to hear more or read more from David Kaiser about this, there's a fascinating article called Operation Neutrino, How the Neutrino Went from Ghost Particle to Vital Physics Tool, A Tale of Bombs, Espionage, and Subtle Flavors. And that is, which publication can that article be found?
It's in a magazine called Aeon.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's an online magazine, A-E-O-N.
Wonderful. Well, Professor Dr. David Kaiser, we'll have you back. Thank you so very much for joining us. And I want to give a heads up to my daughter Chanda for making me aware of this article. She knows how I feel about neutrinos. Thank you so very much.
Well, it's a great pleasure, Margaret. Thank you. And thanks again to Chanda.
Okay. We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.